Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 24th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a nighttime scene. There is a bright spotlight shining on a brick wall, and captured in that spotlight is former President Donald Trump. He's in sort of a traditional burglar outfit. He's got a black and white striped shirt, gray pants, and a little mask over his eyes. Under his right arm, he's carrying a replica of the, looks like the Supreme Court. And in his left hand, it's a bag, looks like a big bag full of money. At any rate, the headline is, "The Big Steal. Did Trump commit crimes by falsely claiming fraud and trying to stage a coup?" And that's our first story. We will start right there. January 6th committee lays out case against Trump. What happened? Former President Donald Trump ignored the urgent advice of aides and clear evidence he lost the 2020 election as he tried to engineer a coup that shook the foundations of American democracy. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol uprising said this week, in the opening of its televised hearings, committee chair Representative Bernie Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi, said that Trump lit the fuse that ultimately resulted in the violence of January 6. Using videotape testimony of former Trump associates, Thompson and Vice Chair Representative Liz Cheney, the Republican from Wyoming, methodically laid out their case that Trump incited the Capitol attack with false claims of fraud and refused to intervene for 187 minutes as his supporters assaulted police officers, smashed through doors and windows, and sent lawmakers scurrying for safety while advisors and family members pleaded with him to call off the mob. Numerous top advisors, including then Attorney General William Barr and campaign manager Bill Stepien, told Trump there was no credible evidence to support nonsensical conspiracy theories about rigged voting machines and suitcases filled with fake ballots. "I told him that the stuff that his people were shoveling out into the public was bullshit," Barr said, calling Trump detached from reality and not interested in actual facts. The opening hearing included harrowing, previously unseen video of rioters smashing windows, savagely attacking police, and chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," a fate that Trump reportedly said his vice president deserved. In live testimony, a Capitol Police officer, Caroline Edwards, described slipping in people's blood amid hours of hand-to-hand combat that left her and more than 140 officers badly injured. "It was carnage," she said. "It was chaos." Trump issued a 12-page rebuttal calling the hearings a ridiculous and treasonous attempt to cover up the fact that Democrats rigged the election. Many Republicans dismissed the hearings as a partisan attack on Trump and the GOP and an effort to distract voters from Democrats' failures on inflation, gas prices, and crime. Cheney, one of two Republicans on the committee, said estranged colleagues who defend Trump are defending the indefensible, adding, "There will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain." What the editorial said. In its riveting presentations, the committee has done more than just remind Americans of that day's horror, said the Washington Post. It has offered compelling new evidence of how Trump launched a frontal assault on U.S. democracy. Some may dismiss this as ancient history, but it assuredly is not. Not only is Trump still considering a 2024 run, Allies determined to remake the Republican Party in his image are currently on ballots all over the country. The hearings are a partisan effort to unfairly besmirch the entire GOP, said the Wall Street Journal. But that doesn't mean Trump's actions weren't a disgrace. He lied repeatedly about an election he'd clearly lost, riled up gullible supporters to march on the Capitol, and dawdled instead of sending help after they turned violent. The person who owns January 6 is Donald Trump, and he's still duping his followers. What the columnist said. Barr and even Trump's daughter, Ivanka, provided damning testimony with real legal implications, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg. They testified that it was clear that the claims of a stolen election were false, which is key to showing Trump intended to commit a crime when he staged an attempted coup. Attorney General Merrick Garland pointedly said this week he and federal prosecutors are watching the hearings. It's now virtually inevitable the famously cautious Garland will launch a criminal investigation of the former president, said Georgetown Law Professor Neil Katyal in the New York Times. The committee has already laid out strong evidence Trump committed serious federal crimes, including attempted obstruction of an official proceeding, in this case the January 6 vote certification. He might also be charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States by collaborating with others to send falsely chosen Republican electors, and with wire fraud for duping his own supporters into donating $250 million for a legal fund to overturn the election, a fund the committee said never existed. By indulging in Trump hatred, Democrats are just paving the way for his return to the Oval Office, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. They've sent a clear signal that they think January 6 is the single most important issue facing the country, not inflation, crime, record gas prices, or the border catastrophe. Most voters are not likely to agree. The danger Trump poses hasn't passed, said Karen Tumulty, also in the Washington Post. Even as the testimony unfolds, Republican candidates trumpeting the big lie are running on promises to further undermine the electoral process, including contenders for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state in key swing states. The sedition continues, and next time, the insurrectionists might succeed. Controversy of the week, gun safety bill. Will it make a difference? Miracles sometimes happen, said Liu Zhao in Vox. That was the message from Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, this week after he and Senator John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, broke an impasse and unveiled a bipartisan proposal for the first substantial federal gun safety legislation in three decades. Negotiated in the wake of two horrific mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas, the bill does not implement the ban on assault weapons and large-capacity magazines sought by President Biden and most Democrats, but the legislation does include several important incremental provisions for reducing school shootings and other gun massacres. Background checks for gun buyers under 21 would require a mandatory search of juvenile justice and mental health records. States would be rewarded with grants to enact red flag laws under which authorities can temporarily seize guns from dangerous individuals. The boyfriend loophole, excluding people convicted of domestic abuse, would be closed. Billions of dollars would be spent on schools' mental health care programs and security mental health services. Some gun safety activists criticized the proposals as inadequate, said Olivier Knox in the Washington Post. But after years of inaction in the face of ever-mounting death tolls, Murphy and other Democrats hope this bill could finally be the crack in the dam that makes additional legislation possible. The compromise bill is a sensible first step in the right direction, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. More money for school security and mental health treatment is an obvious and necessary response to recent events, one that Republicans have long advocated. Just as important is what the bill does not include. Virtue signaling restrictions like a ban on assault weapons or large magazines that infringe on the rights of law-abiding gun owners while doing nothing to stop determined killers. The Uvalde killer took scores of small magazines with him on his rampage and was not close to running out of ammo by the time he was shot dead. If this is the best our lawmakers can do after the slaughter of 19 children, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times, then we are in a very bad place. To actually reduce mass shootings and gun violence, we need a ban on the assault weapons and high-capacity magazines mass shooters often use, as well as mandatory background checks and a waiting period for gun purchasers. California passed such a package. It now has one of the lowest firearm death rates in the nation. Sometimes something is better than nothing, said Ross Rosenfield in the New York Daily News. But not in this case. If they pass this legislation, Republicans get to look like the good guys while doing barely anything at all, and with zero intention of ever passing substantial gun legislation. It's a trick, and the Democrats should avoid falling for it. Cornyn and Murphy are now racing to forge an agreement on the final wording of the bill so it can be passed before the July recess, said Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Some key details are still being hashed out, including potentially fixing a loophole that allows people to sell guns without a license. Closing that loophole alone and cracking down on straw purchases to avoid background checks is real reform that could impact thousands of gun sales per year. Will it prevent this country's monumental loss of life from gun violence? No. It's frustrating, maddening, and tragic. But what is the alternative right now? Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Sarah Palin, who received 30% of the ballots in Alaska's open primary to fill a vacant House seat. Palin emerged from a 48-person field that featured Santa Claus, the actual legal name of a rotund, white-bearded independent from North Pole, Alaska. It was a good week for incentives after Malmo, Sweden, installed two talking trash cans that thank citizens who feed them litter with moans of pleasure and sexy messages such as, "Come back soon and do that again." It was a good week for employee relations after rapper Snoop Dogg revealed that he has raised the salary of his personal blunt roller, a blunt being a big fat marijuana cigarette, to keep pace with inflation. The full-time employee reportedly had been making about $50,000 a year to prepare Snoop's cannabis cigars. But it was a bad week for grift after a report that Donald Trump Jr.'s fiancée, Stephanie Grisham, was paid $60,000 from donated funds for introducing her boyfriend at President Trump's fateful rally on January 6th. It was a bad week for overkill after the funeral of an elderly woman killed by a wild elephant in Odisha, India, was interrupted by the same animal returning to trample her corpse. Conservation lawyer Duncan McNair said the elephant's ability to recognize the body of its victim was proof of extraordinary cognitive abilities. And finally, it was a bad week for ugly Americans after surveillance cameras captured two U.S. tourists hurling an electric scooter down Rome's iconic Spanish steps, causing an estimated $27,000 in damage to the steps. A city spokesman said the young couple was completely drunk. The briefing this week is the rise of legal cannabis. A growing number of states are legalizing recreational marijuana as sales soar. Will there be a hidden cost? Where is weed now legal? The nation has seen a seismic shift since Washington and Colorado became the first states to legalize recreational cannabis a decade ago. Rhode Island recently became the 19th state to end pot prohibition, joining such states as California, New York, Nevada, Virginia, Illinois, and Vermont. Another 20 states have legalized medical marijuana, including Mississippi, Missouri, and West Virginia. Legalization bills for recreational or medicinal marijuana are under consideration in at least a half dozen more states, including Pennsylvania, Kansas, and North Carolina. Some 44% of Americans now live in states that allow recreational cannabis use, and business is booming. How big is it? Last year, sales of legal cannabis hit $25 billion, and they're projected to top $40 billion by 2025 and at least $57 billion by 2030. One major reason states are jumping on the legal bandwagon is that it creates huge tax windfalls. Since license sales began in 2014, states have received $10 billion in various tax revenues, according to the Marijuana Policy Project. It will be an economic engine, said New Jersey State Senator Nicholas Scutari. Both Illinois and Massachusetts took in more tax dollars last year from marijuana than from alcohol sales. The $112 million Massachusetts collected more than tripled initial projections. And cannabis entrepreneurs are salivating over the official opening of the legal market in New York City, where the first legal sellers may be licensed by year's end, and many city streets already reek of weed. New York is going to be Amsterdam on steroids, said cannabis investor Gene Sullivan. But as bud tenders at legal dispensaries do a boffo trade in gummies, tinctures, and high-grade sativa strains, some question whether there are underappreciated costs of legalizing cannabis. What are the downsides? Legalization, not surprisingly, leads to a lot more people getting stoned, for some, every day. The percentage of Americans over 26 who reported using cannabis in a given month doubled between 2010 and 2020, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. In Colorado, one of the first states to legalize, 48% of cannabis users get high nearly every day. A 2019 study led by an NYU epidemiologist found adult marijuana use was 26% higher in legalized states compared with non-legalized ones, and problem use among teens was 25% higher. The negative consequences of widespread frequent use are on the rise. The percentage of motor vehicle fatalities involving cannabis more than doubled from 2000 to 2018, according to a recent analysis. It's a huge emerging issue, said Helen Whitty, former president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Some studies have found evidence that cannabis use in people under 18 leads to stunted cognitive development and poor academic performance. Doctors are also sounding the alarm about mental disturbances linked to the use of cannabis, in particular the hyperpotent extracts sold at legal dispensaries. What's the connection? Study after study has shown a link between marijuana use and schizophrenia and psychosis in people with a predisposition to mental illness. While these studies invite questions about causality, a panel of 16 experts convened by the National Academy of Medicine in 2017 judged cannabis use likely to increase the risk of developing those disorders, noting the higher the use, the greater the risk. Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has said there is a very significant rise in psychosis connected to marijuana use. The staggering potency of marijuana concentrates such as candies and vaping oils, which can carry THC levels as high as 90%, compared with 5% in pot smoked decades ago, is triggering psychotic episodes, says doctors. Almost every day I see such a patient, said Brad Roberts, an emergency room physician in Pueblo, Colorado. Doctors also report growing cases of cannabinoid hypermesis syndrome involving intense, uncontrollable vomiting and cannabis use disorder, which the CDC defines as an inability to stop using the drug despite causing health and social problems. Up to 3 in 10 cannabis users become problem users, studies suggest. Dependency is a greater risk than people assume, said Deborah Hasson, an epidemiologist at Columbia University. What might be done? Some states, including Washington and Colorado, are considering capping the potency of cannabis products, a move that's met with opposition from the cannabis industry. Currently, only Vermont has a potency cap. Some doctors and lawmakers are pushing for warning labels. One under consideration in California would cite a potential link to psychotic disorders. Experts are not calling for recriminalizing marijuana, but want more education about the potential downsides of frequent use. The concern, they say, is the message that getting stoned is just harmless fun or even good for you, a message that massive legal marijuana industry is promoting. The risks are being hidden, said Runit Lev, an addiction specialist at Scripps Mercy Hospital in San Diego. I want the public to make informed decisions. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. First up, the $100 fill-up has arrived. For the first time, the cost of filling up my Jeep crossed into triple digits last week, said Kevin Williamson. As Americans pay $100 for a tank of gas, their anger at President Biden is growing. And so are the chances that Democrats will be wiped out in November's congressional elections. Most Americans rely on their cars, and we get very irritated when somebody stands between us and where we are trying to go. Every fill-up in this new era of $5 a gallon gas is a little slap in the face, accompanied by a sinking suspicion that prices are never going back down. Smart Republicans will capitalize on unprecedented gas prices and mention them in every single speech. Those prices affect voters directly, painfully, and frequently, and will motivate most of them more than any other single issue, including gun control and abortion. Biden and the Democrats are whining about the unfairness of blaming them for inflation, including rising gas prices. Inflation may not be 100% the Democrats' fault, but they have made it worse with their wild spending and other policies. Biden's forte was supposedly kitchen table economic issues for middle class Americans, but they may be his undoing. And Biden isn't going down alone. When every building is hardened, to appease Second Amendment absolutists, said Philip Kennicott, We are being told that we must harden schools, churches, and synagogues, hospitals, and every public space against the armed assault. This means all school children will need to pass through military-style checkpoints every morning, eyed by armed cops or guards. Many public spaces, like the Capitol building and state houses, would become permanently off-limits, while others would be equipped with surveillance cameras, robust security databases, facial recognition technology, artificial intelligence systems, and, of course, hardened entrances. Buildings will be designed or redesigned to promote not beauty or civic pride, but security. We'll all live under constant authoritarian oversight. Is this really the future we want? Schools, libraries, houses of worship, and places of entertainment used to greet us with a promise. Enter and learn, enter and pray, enter and engage with art, theater, dance, or music. But when universal, unregulated access to weapons designed for mass killing is considered a right that trumps all others, public spaces will become fortresses where everyone is viewed with wariness and suspicion. This column comes from Spain. The troubling turn toward endless war. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has inspired a new passion for war across the planet, said Jordi Juan. We thought the trauma of the Cold War, with its numerous superpower proxy conflicts and its constant threat of nuclear annihilation, had ended in 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved. Common sense prevailed and dialogue won the battle. Indeed, for the three decades since then, ideals of peace, dialogue, and demilitarization ruled, at least among the biggest powers. But Russia shattered that consensus with its mass invasion in February, and since then, other major countries have embraced the revival of the arms race. China has multiplied investment in defense, building a naval base in Cambodia and testing nuclear-capable hypersonic missiles. Iran has enriched enough uranium for an atomic bomb. And North Korea has tormented its neighbors with missile launches as it prepares for a possible nuclear test. Even the European Union has taken a decisive step toward militarization by approving its first common European defense policy. You can already imagine who's benefiting. Defense contractors in the U.S. and elsewhere are primed to make billions. This new arms race may be one of the most negative consequences of the invasion of Ukraine. Why, then, has there been hardly any debate on the subject? The last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, interestingly, Selling Albert Einstein. An enterprising lawyer made Einstein into one of the world's best-paid dead celebrities, said Simon Parkin in The Guardian. Einstein himself would most likely have been shocked. In July 2003, the physicist and Pulitzer Prize-nominated author Tony Rothman received an email from his editor bearing unwelcome news. Rothman's new book was weeks from publication, an affable debunking of widely misunderstood stories from the history of science. Its title, Everything's Relative, was a playful nod to Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Rothman had asked his publisher, Wiley, to put a picture of history's most famous scientist on the cover. An issue just came up, the email read. Rothman's editor had been warned that Einstein's estate was extremely aggressive and litigious. Unless the publisher paid a hefty fee to use the image of Einstein, the editor explained, they could be sued. Rothman was dismayed. I think this is ridiculous, he replied via email. If the estate went after everybody who used Einstein's image, they'd have no time on their hands for anything else. Are you sure they even own it? Rothman's editor was unwilling to investigate the legal technicalities. When Everything's Relative finally appeared in bookshops, the cover showed a puff of clouds that spelled out the world's most famous formula, E equals MC squared. The equation's author was nowhere to be seen. Albert Einstein died in 1955. In Article 13 of his last will and testament, he pledged that his manuscripts, copyrights, publication rights, royalties, and all other literary property would, upon the deaths of his secretary, Helen Dukas, and stepdaughter, Margot Einstein, pass to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, an institution that Einstein co-founded in 1918. Einstein made no mention in his will about the use of his name or likeness on books, products, or advertisements. Today, these are known as publicity rights. But at the time Einstein was writing his will, no such legal concept existed. When the Hebrew University took control of Einstein's estate in 1982, however, publicity rights had become a fierce legal battleground, worth millions of dollars each year. In the mid-1980s, the university began to assert control over who could use Einstein's name and likeness, and at what cost. Potential licensors were told to submit proposals, which would then be assessed by unnamed arbitrators behind closed doors. An Einstein-branded diaper? No. An Einstein-branded calculator? Yes. Anyone who did not follow this process or defied the university's decision could be subject to legal action. Sellers of Einstein-themed T-shirts, Halloween costumes, coffee beans, SUV trucks, and cosmetics found themselves in court. Einstein had been a well-paid man. His $10,000 salary at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, roughly $180,000 in today's money, was set by the Institute to exceed that of any American scientist. Isn't that too much? Einstein queried at the time. But his earnings in life were insignificant compared with his earnings in death. From 2006 to 2017, he featured every year in Forbes' list of the 10 highest earning historic figures, dead celebrities in the publication's rather diminishing term, bringing in an average of $12.5 million a year in licensing fees for the Hebrew University, which is the top-ranking university in Israel. A conservative estimate puts Einstein's post-mortem earnings for the university to date at $250 million. His intellect made Einstein famous, but it was his appearance that made him an icon. Few understood the implications of his work. 4,000 bewildered as Einstein speaks, wrote the New York Times. But his image, spread via the accelerating technologies of print and TV, was eminently approachable. The frazzled hair, the frowsy jumper, the caterpillar mustache, the hangdog jowls, and those sad galactic eyes. Einstein's image endeared him to the world, suggesting that here was a mind too occupied with higher questions to spare much thought to, say, a comb. Before Einstein died at age 76, he made plans to prevent posthumous idolatry, leaving instructions with his trusted friend and executor of his estate, the economist Otto Nathan. Einstein wanted his body to be cremated and the ashes scattered over the Delaware River on the Atlantic coast. There would be no shrine. His work alone would be his legacy. This did not prevent the theft of his brain, which was extracted and preserved by Thomas Harvey, chief pathologist at the hospital where Einstein died. Harvey hoped to keep for study the most impressive organ humanity had yet produced. In terms of future dividends, however, Harvey picked the wrong relic. It was not Einstein's brain the world wanted. It was his face. Whenever he walked into the living room of his parents' house in the town of Washington, New York, Roger Richmond saw a framed photograph of Albert Einstein standing with his father. Richmond's father, Paul, had befriended Einstein in the 1930s when they worked together to help German Jews resettle in Alaska, Paraguay, and Mexico. At the time, most of the U.S. was closed to those fleeing Nazi oppression. Richmond's father died in 1955, 3 months after Einstein, but the Richmond family remained close to the keepers of Einstein's legacy. Richmond became a lawyer and in 1978 founded an agency that specialized in product placement in film and TV. The following year, the heirs of the late American comedian W.C. Fields contacted his office. They wanted Richmond to become his agent, a surprising request given that Fields had been dead for 32 years. While researching the law, Richmond found a case involving the son of Bela Lugosi, the Hungarian-American actor best remembered for his performance of Dracula, that suggested that the heirs of celebrities who had sold their images during their lifetime had a claim on the publicity rights. An opportunity to test his theory came a few months later when Richmond learned the U.S. Postal Service planned to produce a commemorative stamp in honor of W.C. Fields' 100th birthday. After initial protestation, the Postal Service paid its first license fee to the estate of a dead celebrity. Richmond soon built an enviable roster of deceased clients, which included Marilyn Monroe and Sigmund Freud. Descendants of late celebrities were often pleased to hear from Richmond, who offered them a way to protect their loved ones from legacy tainting associations and to make some money along the way. Advertisers, too, were eager to collaborate with the dead, who, unlike the living, did not become embroiled in news scandals, fail to turn up for expensive photo shoots, or demand costly contract renegotiations. To add legal heft to his threats, W.C. Fields' grandson, Everett, suggested that Richmond draft a celebrity rights law. Richmond wrote more than 80 letters to widows and orphans of celebrity greats and amassed a group of powerful supporters, including Elizabeth Taylor, Elvis Presley's ex-wife Priscilla, and Bing Crosby's widow Catherine. After two rejections, the California Celebrity Rights Act passed on January 1, 1985. In California, at least, heirs could now legally inherit the publicity rights of their celebrity ancestors who had died in the state. With a legal precedent established in California, Richmond was in business. It was time, he decided, to come to the rescue of his father's old friend, Albert Einstein. After the passage of the Celebrity Rights Act, Richmond began to collect clippings of advertisements that featured Einstein. He sent a folder of this material, everything from ads for cars to ads for hair salons, to Einstein's executor, Otto Nathan, with a letter asking whom he should contact to, as he put it, prevent this kind of abuse. Nathan forwarded the clippings to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Seeing an opportunity to exert some influence over the use of Einstein's likeness, on July 1, 1985, the university appointed Richmond as Einstein's exclusive worldwide agent. The university took a 65% cut from every license deal, or 50-50 for the proceeds of successful legal actions against infringers. Computer manufacturers were especially eager to associate their products with Einstein. In 1997, Richmond received word that Apple wanted to use Einstein's photograph to advertise its Mac computer alongside the slogan, "Think Different." After Richmond had negotiated what he believed to be a fair fee of $600,000, he received a call from Apple's co-founder, Steve Jobs, demanding a reduction. "I explained there was only one Albert Einstein," Richmond wrote in his memoirs. "If the fee was too high," he said, "Jobs could license Mae West instead." She thought different also. Jobs paid up. Richmond resented the fact that he was often depicted in court and in the press as a marketing ghoul. It was a hurtful portrayal, he wrote, especially since I had written laws preventing snakes to slither into everyone's life. Richmond considered it troubling, too, that as a Jewish entrepreneur, he was routinely portrayed as an opportunistic money grubber. It was indisputable, however, that Richmond was committed to securing the Hebrew University and himself the most favorable terms. Emboldened by success, Richmond even began to target companies that used Einstein's name without any intended association with the physicist. Einstein Brothers Bagels caved to the university's demands, despite being named after its own founders. Throughout the 1990s, Ze'ev Rosenkrantz, curator at the Einstein Archives at the Hebrew University in Israel, received as many as 30 faxes a month from Richmond's office in Beverly Hills. Each fax contained a proposal from a different company that hoped to use Einstein's name or likeness in its product or service. Everything from antibiotics to computers, cameras to soft drinks. It was up to Rosenkrantz, a young academic who, through his work preserving Einstein's paper, was intimately familiar with the scientist's thoughts and values, to bless or veto each offer. The responsibility was overwhelming, Rosenkrantz told me recently. I am a historian, not a businessman. But somehow the university had decided that this would be my role. Rosenkrantz was uneasy about this. He believed Einstein would have been against most, if not all, marketing associations. If it was purely commercial, he was usually against it, he said. Yet Richmond put pressure on him to approve a far wider range of proposals. Rosenkrantz recalled that when he rejected a deal from Huggies Diapers, Richmond was particularly unhappy. It wasn't purely about profit for him, recalled Rosenkrantz, but in the end it was a business, and I am in academia. It was not an easy topic. Before he sold his agency and its roster of dead legends to the photo agency Corbis in 2005, Richmond persuaded the Hebrew University to file a slew of trademarks for Einstein-related products, which, he argued, would be easier to defend across legal jurisdictions according to established trademark laws. Soon, the university held trademarks for Albert Einstein on nearly 200 separate items, including metal detectors, umbrellas, arcade games, Christmas tree decorations, butterfly nets, water squirting toys, and life-size cardboard cutouts. Richmond died in 2013, and now a panel of experts at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem considers license requests with the power to bless or veto. The process applies to commercial requests. Media outlets use photographs of Einstein to illustrate stories like this one by existing deals with the university has in place with photo libraries such as Getty. What would Einstein have made of his presence on the TV screens, billboards, posters, and T-shirts of the 21st century? Would he have been happy with the Hebrew University's stewardship of his legacy? In life, he often felt seen but not heard. It is strange to be known so universally and yet to be so lonely, he once said. When I spoke to Rosenkrantz, he proposed several scenarios. He might have been happy that the university was profiting from his likeness financially, he said. Part of him, the macho bravado side, would have just reacted to it with a shoulder shrug. But finally, Rosenkrantz concluded, it probably would have bothered him. No, I'm not sure if he would have been happy. Nonetheless, the Einstein money continues to roll in, while the university's reputation continues to have a powerful deterrent effect. A former curator at one of London's most famous museums told me that he had removed Einstein's image from publicity materials on the advice of a colleague. Not long ago, to simplify the process and assuage such fears, Greenlight writes, the rebranded Corbis, launched a website where would-be licenses can apply to use Einstein's name, likeness, or quotations. Applications are filtered and passed onto the Hebrew University's Einstein panel to make the ultimate decision. The name of the site is straightforward, einstein.biz. A version of this story originally appeared in The Guardian. Here's a health and science piece. Sounds interesting. Why giraffes grew a long neck. It has long been believed that giraffes evolved their serpentine necks to pluck leaves from African treetops. But researchers have a new theory, reports Smithsonian. They think the necks became elongated to help the animals compete for mates, not just reach for food. They came to that conclusion after analyzing fossils of Discocuri exitsi, a sheep-sized early ancestor of the giraffe, found in China. The specimen, which dated back around 17 million years, had an almost helmet-like feature around its head and bulky vertebra in the neck, perfect for absorbing and delivering skull-cracking blows to vanquish its rivals. To the best of our knowledge, the researchers write, D. zishi exhibits the most optimized headbutting adaptation in vertebra evolution. A modern male giraffe, eager to trounce its challenger, swings his neck own around violently to use his head as a battering weapon. The new research suggests that over millennia, such a fighting style may have helped select forever longer necks. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled, Pro Golf, Selling Out to Saudi Wealth. Some of the world's top golfers have traded their principles for obscene wealth that is stained by blood, said Kurt Streeter in the New York Times. Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, and Sergio Garcia are among the stars who are quitting America's PGA Tour for the upstart Saudi Arabia-funded LIV Golf Series, creating an ugly schism in the golf world. Tiger Woods declined a reported $500 million payday to join the Saudi Tour, but Mickelson, who's made nearly $100 million in career PGA prize money, but racked up tens of millions of dollars in gambling debt, sold out to the Saudis for a reported $200 million. He has admitted that the LIV is backed by scary mother effers, citing the Saudis' savage murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, their chronic human rights violations, and their public beheadings. But as South African Charles Schwartzel said last week after winning $4.75 million at the LIV's inaugural tournament in London, if you're paid millions, why ask where the money comes from? Let's face it, said Dan Walken in the USA Today, the ultra-rich Saudis have been so successful in buying people because there's always someone willing to be bought. The LIV kickoff event paid $25 million in prize money, while the Masters, the top-paying U.S. event, has a $15 million purse. The last-place finisher in London earned $120,000, whereas most PGA events pay nothing to players who miss the weekend cut. Golfers are not unique in taking dirty money, said Will Leitch in New York Magazine. The NBA is planning exhibition games in the United Arab Emirates, where gay people face execution. Many American racehorses are backed by Saudi princes. Pro sports leagues and athletes go where the money is, just like any business. But this new golf tour isn't about business, said Barry Savolga in the Washington Post. With no TV contract, the Saudis will lose hundreds of millions of dollars on this tour. They're simply buying the reputation of admired golfers to make a murderous regime seem more appealing. It's the same reason Russia, China, and Nazi Germany wanted to host Olympic Games. It's called sports washing, said Greg Coat in the Miami Herald. But ultimately, this tour will fail in its mission. Saudi Arabia's reputation for human rights violations is so richly earned, not even soul-selling pro golfers can make it go away. COVID. The variants keep coming. Previous COVID surges had recognizable peaks, said Chaz Danner in the New York Magazine. But this one might be more like a flood. Omicron's BA.2.1.2.1 subvariant, which can evade antibodies from vaccination and prior infections, has been quietly infecting millions of Americans for months, but may soon be outcompeted by two new subvariants, BA.4 and BA.5. These highly mutated versions of the coronavirus are now causing more than 20% of U.S. infections and appear to be more transmissible, more able to cause breakthrough infections in the vaccinated, and more likely to reinfect those who've already caught COVID. As BA.4 and BA.5 spread in a largely mask-free country, they will cause a lot of breakthrough infections and reinfections, including among people who were sickened by the original Omicron strain a few months ago. The new strains do not seem to cause more severe illness, but the overlapping waves of subvariants could make this a sustained spread summer. The new subvariants appear to behave differently than their predecessors do, said Catherine Wu in The Atlantic, with shorter incubation periods and sneezier, head cold-esque symptoms. More worryingly, home tests increasingly fail to detect these infections until 4 or 5 days after COVID symptoms appear, which means people could spread the virus without realizing it. So where's the urgency to help people fight off these viral invaders, said Andrew Romano in Yahoo News. Congressional Republicans are blocking the already whittled down $10 billion COVID package, and there is no Operation Warp Speed for next generation vaccines or improvement in indoor ventilation, which can greatly reduce infection rates. The country has sunk into COVID complacency. That may mean that people get COVID multiple times, raising their risk of long COVID and a host of lingering symptoms. Kavanaugh threat. Are Democrats to blame? It's shocking but not surprising that a deranged California man traveled to Maryland last week to kill Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. The would-be assassin was arrested after he appeared outside Kavanaugh's guarded home with, armed with a Glock 17 handgun, pepper spray, and zip ties. His mission was the inevitable next phase of the intimidation campaign directed at conservative justices following the leak of a draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade. Attorney General Merrick Garland has failed to enforce a federal law forbidding protest outside the justices' homes, and many Democrats have served up incendiary rhetoric about the court. A prime example was when Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer said Kavanaugh and Justice Neil Gorsuch would pay the price if they voted to overturn abortion. Since Democrats blamed Donald Trump's rhetoric for inciting the January 6 riot, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post, they can't absolve Schumer of any responsibility when a potential assassin shows up at Kavanaugh's home. That incident was genuinely disturbing, said Kathy Young in the Bulwark, but comparing it to January 6 is some major whataboutery. Schumer made that statement 2 years ago, and progressives didn't then rampage through the Supreme Court building. Kavanaugh's potential attacker did not act violently or try to enter Kavanaugh's home and call police to report himself as suicidal and mentally ill. It looks more like the proverbial cry for help than an actual attempted assassination. The protests outside Kavanaugh's house have been uniformly peaceful, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. As for Schumer, who has protesters outside his home on a constant basis, he made it clear in those 2020 comments that he was talking about political consequences for overturning Roe, saying to Republicans, you're going to be gone in November. Still, the Kavanaugh incident feels like a harbinger of more ugliness to come, said Noah Feldman and Bloomberg. In today's feverish atmosphere, both conservative and liberal Supreme Court justices have become targets of public wrath, in need of round-the-clock security. And just as resistance to Roe engendered murderous attacks on abortion doctors and clinics over the decades, its reversal might inflame passions to an extent we cannot yet anticipate. The consequences for how justices live will be permanent. Here's a short note or two. The average price of a gallon of gas across the nation has hit $5 a gallon for the first time ever, after climbing 19 cents in a week. It's up nearly $2 from this time last year. The Biden administration has abandoned a plan proposed by former President Trump to change the exterior paint scheme for Air Force One from blue and white to red, white, and blue. The Air Force determined that darkening the colors, which date to John F. Kennedy's presidency, would lead to increased heating by the sun and create engine heat problems. And we will finish today's show with a quote from Will Rogers, quoted in the Texarkana Gazette. He says, if all politicians fished instead of spoke publicly, we would be at peace with the world. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.